This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, listeners, our topic is diet and nutrition. And I welcome your questions for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. She joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. So if you have questions about diet and nutrition, give us a call. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Susan Kundrat is a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. She specializes in developing personalized nutrition plans for athletes and the general public. She's an adjunct lecturer with the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and she is the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. The book is published by Coach's Choice, and you can find Susan on the web at www.nutritiononthemove.net. Again, questions about diet and nutrition are invited this afternoon. Again, the phone number is 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. It's a nice brisk day.
It is. It's brisk, but it's sunny.
It is. It's very bright.
That's very good. Well, we got a message over the email this morning from someone who has been diagnosed with levels of methylmercury higher than the safe level, but below those of really, you know, where you're really going to run into trouble. And so this listener was wondering how to proceed. And the listener says that fish are out of the diet now. And I guess that's the bottom line for this individual. But I don't know that you'll be able to talk precisely about this individual's situation medically, because you're not a medical doctor and you're not a toxicologist. But any information you could share with us would be useful, and I'm sure people in the audience would find anything you could say about which fish to enjoy and which fish to limit, and or the good stuff that's in fish, can we find it in supplement form, and how do we incorporate that into our diet?
Yes, I think you know, there is a lot of confusion about fish, and even a couple days ago I heard a big report about people saying, well, we still don't eat enough fish to get the benefit we should get from fish, but yet people are concerned about this very fact about the mercury. And so, I mean, one thing to think about is to go for the fish that still are really good for you but tend to be lower mercury. And those are things, you know, the typical things that we might eat, flounder, haddock, a lot of the white fish, because it's not as high in fat as well. But even, you know, even things like salmon, if it's freshwater salmon or canned salmon, or tuna, if it's light tuna, or if it's fresh tuna, tilapia, whitefish, things like that, that are generally considered very low risk in terms of low mercury levels. You know, the ones that we tend to be the most concerned about are things like mackerel, sometimes even depending upon how they are actually raised. That's really a big question, which are they farmed or are they actually fresh? So if you can get more fresh, that's better with some of these different fish. And I think that things like shark and swordfish and those types of fish we tend to think of as much higher mercury fish. And so really trying to stay away from those fish for sure. But, you know, if you look at the omega-3 benefit, which is really the, you know, two things in fish that we think are probably the most important. One is quality protein, and the second is the omega-3 fatty acids, which are definitely helpful for a lot of things, particularly cardiovascular risk reduction. Then you look at things like if it's a freshwater salmon, for example, because that's pretty high in omega-3s, but would also be tend to be lower in mercury for the overall benefit.
And I think one of the keys to this is think about the size of the fish. If it's a really big fish, it tends to be one of the more loaded
fish more problematic
with mercury and other chemicals, I would imagine, because they're eating much more of the, you know, they're taking in a lot of more of the environment.
Exactly.
I think that's correct.
Right.
So enjoy the things that are low, that are small and low in mercury, and stay away from the other fish. And again, what about the supplements, though?
I think that, supplements have come under a lot of scrutiny, too, to make sure that if you're getting an omega-3 supplement, is it mercury-free? Is it lead-free? Is it free of other things that might be a problem? And so we do have reviews that, anyone can go look at. You know, one of the most popular ones is on the website Consumer Lab, consumerlab.com. You can subscribe to that for, I think, about $30 a month, where you can get the full reviews of the supplements that have passed their purity and safety. And also you can get lists of a few that have by not even subscribing, but just getting on the website. And they publish periodic reviews of different supplements, including omega-3s. And so I typically we think about it as the same thing we're thinking about with most supplements. If it's a company that you're familiar with, a larger company, if it's a company that will share their data with you, if you ask for safety data, yes, tell you how they do safety checking and things like that, then those are better, typically better companies. If it's a company that you can't get that information from, or if they say it's a proprietary blend where they won't give you any information about the product, then we might have a little more concern with those products, because we'd like to see, we'd like to have it be all clear and plain. And then there are other ways, you know, things like walnuts, for example, are high in the good fats, are high in omega-3 fatty acids. And so I have a lot of people who maybe don't eat the fish, but they might eat more walnuts, and they would eat more flaxseed, which is a little different type of fatty acid, but still we think in some ways protective. And so there are ways to say, well, yes, I'm going to get more nuts and seeds and soybeans and flaxseed and things like that, to also just try to get more of these healthier fats, and maybe still have the fish, but be very careful with the types of fish that I am consuming.
Okay, very good. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. Your questions about diet and nutrition are invited this afternoon. The numbers, if you'd like to join us with a phone call. The telephone number is in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. Well, what would you like to talk about while we wait for our listeners to join us this afternoon?
Well, along the lines of the last question that we went over, I think there is something to kind of keep in mind when we look at omega-3 fatty acids and we look at eating fish, and that is, and this is somewhat controversial, but where the recommendations lie for different folks, different types of people. And so just for general preventative maintenance, basically to stay healthy, if you don't have any cardiovascular disease, trying to get some of these better choices of fish two or three times a week is really what we recommend. For those people who already have coronary heart disease, they have high lipids or they have high triglycerides or they've had a coronary event, then we really do look at saying, well, probably they need more. We don't have a lot of evidence to say, well, if you supplement with 1 or 2 or 3 grams of omega-3 fats, that's going to be that helpful if you've never had any problem. But we know if somebody already has had a coronary problem, then if we look at the American Heart Association recommendations, it's about 1 gram of EPA and DHA, which are the main fatty acids found in, main omega-3 fatty acids found in fish, per day. And so then if someone has high triglycerides, it might be more than that. And of course, all that should be done with your physician's guidance on that too. So I think it does kind of depend on where you are along the lines. If you've already had a problem heart-wise, then gosh, you really do need to think maybe of other ways, if you're not going to get it in fish itself, of looking at the supplement, because we know that it might be more protective if you've already had a problem.
Okay. Our lines are all filled up at the moment, so let's go and talk with some listeners. Our first caller this afternoon in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. I have a friend who suffers greatly from rheumatoid arthritis, and I was wondering, in this family of diseases, which are sort of autoimmune diseases, are there any dietary supplements that can be of assistance in helping with some of the symptoms, the pain, the stiffness, and the joint issues that they suffer?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've talked a bit about the omega-3 fatty acids, and definitely that's something that we look to as a potential help, because omega-3 fats, we know, can decrease inflammation in some people. And so in something like rheumatoid arthritis or other inflammatory-type diseases, sometimes these can be of help. And I'll often have clients who are on other medications for anti-inflammation, and they may also be trying to utilize omega-3 fatty acids or supplements in addition to that. One thing I will say is that, again, whenever you use them more medically or use them at higher levels like that, it should definitely be monitored by your physician or by your healthcare provider, because in higher levels of these anti-inflammatories, they can also cause blood thinning and maybe cause some other interactions with other medications someone is on. So we look at things like that. We also look at there certainly are some herbs and spices that might be helpful as well. And even we're seeing all this information on cinnamon and cumin and some of these other spices that they might have anti-inflammatory properties. And so I think that that's a possibility as well. But the thing that I always look for the first is really the omega-3s, because it does seem in many cases, and with backing from studies, that those could be anti-inflammatory.
And again, this is something that should be monitored with a physician
yes,
or other health professional.
Right. It should be, because, again, once you get to higher doses of some of these, if you had fish twice or three times a week, again, from a fatty acid standpoint, typically not anywhere near enough to cause any blood thinning. But once you get to 1, 2, 3 grams or more a day, which is more therapeutic levels, then there can be some other side effects like blood thinning. And also there can be some interactions with other medications someone is on. And so that's really a good rule of thumb anytime you're taking an extra supplement. If it's quite a bit more than the recommended levels for health, then there also could be other side effects that just need to be monitored, make sure that's okay.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Next, we talk with a listener in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hi.
Hello. You hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
With regard to osteoporosis, is the calcium contained in antacid tablets available to resupply the bone?
The calcium that's in antacid is available. We generally recommend that if you really need a lot of calcium, that you don't just use something like an antacid tablet, because that can, of course, change the acidity of your stomach, and that might have other repercussions for what you're absorbing. And so let's say, if you've used something like Tums or something like that that has calcium in it as well, that might be something you use, maybe once a day or, depending upon your own health needs a little bit. But also, if you really need more calcium, you might consider other calcium supplements as well. Usually it's a calcium carbonate or a calcium citrate supplement. Those are typically the two that are most often used, and not just relying on the antacids, because what sometimes happens is you end up taking more for the calcium, but then again you affect the acidity of the stomach, and then that can cause other absorption issues and things like that.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Next, we talk with a listener in Crystal Lake, line 2. Hi.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I was wondering, I have vertigo, and I was wondering, is there anything I could do I've been trying to eat a lot of natural foods, but is there like some kind of supplements outside of some natural herbs and spices maybe?
Well, one thing we look at with vertigo is trying to make sure the sodium is controlled, because that can affect the fluid balance in the body. So you might have been told to go on a low-sodium diet or monitor your sodium intake.
Correct.
And that seems to be therapeutically the thing that might be of most help. And as you mentioned, maybe adding some other herbs and spices that don't have sodium but make food taste good is really great, because that's going to be very helpful for you. And the one thing you can look at are things like garlic powder and onion powder and some of these other herbs that aren't a garlic salt or a salt mixture or things. And just to be really wary, because a lot of seasonings might not say salt, but they can be still very high in sodium depending upon what they've added to them. So that seems to be the main thing that we look at now. I don't know of any other, supplements per se that do have a positive, have positive effect on vertigo or help you get through that. But really it seems to be related mostly to the fluid balance. And of course, whenever we take in more salt in the diet, our fluid balance changes, because our body always tries to stay in sync, so it tends to hold on to more water. and then that can affect the pressure, which can affect vertigo. So that's from what I know, the biggest combination or the biggest connection we have.
Well, thank you very much. The only thing I was wondering, though, I just came up with this about 4 or 5 years ago, and I'm 51 now. I just came up like 46, I think it was, 47. I normally, and I'm pretty healthy, I did a lot of physical exercises and stuff, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, I got it. Is there any reason why? I mean, nobody's been able to tell me how come I ended up with it. I've always had kind of a weird sense of balance anyway. I mean, I could balance myself, but it's more to the right than in the left. But would that cause it? I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks. Well, I think I don't really know. I mean, nutritionally, it's not usually something nutritionally that does cause it, as far as I know. I think it may just be other medical things going on. And so I don't know that I'm qualified to answer that. But I do know more from a treatment standpoint, not necessarily from, in other words, if you eat a high salt diet, it's not necessarily going to cause somebody to have vertigo or cause problems like that. But it may help manage it. So mm-hmm. I don't know from a nutrition standpoint if there would have been anything necessarily that would have been a reason that you developed that.
Yeah. This morning on Focus 580, Dr. Jeff Swearingen was a guest.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things they talked about, David Inge and Dr. Swearingen, was the amount of sodium in processed food. So mm-hmm. that's something to watch.
Exactly.
As well.
I was just going to say it can be just so much higher than you really think, because our national guidelines now are anywhere from 1,500 milligrams a day to 2,000 milligrams a day just for general health. And certainly if you went for a fast food restaurant meal, for example, you could easily get over 2,000 milligrams in that meal. Or if you had two servings of soup from canned soup, mm-hmm. you could easily get 2,000 milligrams in some cases. So it's very easy. You know, I think the average intake is around 4,000 milligrams a day of what we eat. So it's very easy to get a lot more than we need for the body.
Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line 3. Hi.
Hi. One of the things I was wondering about, well, I've been taking a statin for about 6 years for high cholesterol. And in the last year or so, I've decided to implement whey into my workout routine, post-workout routine.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been getting the stuff from GNC. And then the last time I bought one, I noticed on the label the amount of cholesterol in there. And they say it's 23% of your daily intake. How foolish was that?
Well, I think that typically when you get just 100% whey product, it's not going to be very high in cholesterol because it's generally not going to have much fat. But it might be that you got a product that also had more fat in it. So you could, what I would say is, you know, the whey can be very helpful after a workout. So I think that was smart. And the thing you want to look for is just a product that is just a non-fat. It's just whey protein, maybe flavored, but not with any of the milk fat added,
mm-hmm.
or not with any of the natural milk fat in there, in which case it should be quite low and shouldn't be a big deal. 23% of the daily intake, if we look at that, you know, that may be 70 or 80 milligrams of cholesterol. It's not a lot in that serving, so you're still going to be, that wouldn't, to me, say, well, gosh, that's been a problem. You know, that's probably caused more problems. I don't think it's enough to do that. So I don't think you should worry about that necessarily, but just choose next time you go get it, you know, really try to choose one that's skim milk or skim, no fat in it, just 100% whey protein without the cholesterol, and you should be in good shape.
Okay, thank you.
Next, we talk with a listener in Paris, Illinois, line 1. Hi.
Hello there. That me?
That's you.
Me.
You okay. Are on the air. Hi.
Thank you. What is it about coffee that interferes with calcium absorption? I hear that coffee actually takes calcium away from teeth. Is that true?
Well, one thing that we're concerned about is caffeine, because mm-hmm. caffeine, whether it's in coffee or tea, can bind with some of the calcium and decrease calcium absorption. So that's really the main concern we have. There may be some other tannins in coffee or some other components in coffee that also affect calcium absorption a little bit, but generally, the thing that I'm most concerned about anyway is caffeine. And so if someone... Go ahead.
What about tea? Is it just as bad, or is it slightly bitter?
Well, tea also has some of these. Certainly, if it's caffeinated, it's going to have the caffeine, and then it also has some of the other components, particularly these tannins, that also might affect calcium absorption. And so what I would say is have them in moderation. If you had a cup of coffee or 2 cups of coffee or tea a day, and you're still getting 1,000, 1,200, 1,300, 1,400 milligrams of calcium, depending upon your needs, then that I don't think is enough to worry about. But we do see problems, particularly with people who drink a lot of maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 cups of coffee a day, and they're getting maybe 2 or 3 servings of calcium, then the balance is really off there, that we could have more of a problem. But sometimes we read a report and then we think, gosh, should I even have a cup of coffee? And it doesn't seem like that's enough to cause a major problem.
Well, I was hoping that tea was slightly bitter at least. Well, is there a difference between, how about a difference between black tea and green tea? They keep telling us that we should have some green tea instead of the black tea. Would there be a difference there or not? Still all tea?
It depends on the caffeine amount, but typically the caffeine in tea is less than coffee for the amount that you drink, so that would drop down, the risk there. Mm-hmm. And I would also say if you're very concerned, then I would choose a decaf variety, in which case you still might have a little, problem, the fact that it's tea, but yet if you're not getting as much caffeine, then that seems to be a lot better for you. And tea, like we know, there have been a lot of reports out on tea and coffee lately on the potential health benefits and maybe helping with diabetes and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And certainly if you look at the antioxidants too, there's good antioxidants in black tea as well as green tea. And so both those things are healthy options to drink. So I guess if you ranked them, I might put tea above coffee in some ways, and then just really monitor the caffeine intake.
Yeah. Well, what about, now there isn't any caffeine in things like peppermint tea, is there?
No, generally those are more an herbal tea. So the herbal teas themselves usually don't have caffeine. They don't have the same because they're not actual tea, they also maybe don't have the same beneficial effects of tea what you'd find in actual teas as well. But no, generally they're just more of an herbal or flavored beverage.
Okay, I have one more question. What about alcohol? Does it interfere with absorption of calcium?
Alcohol can interfere a bit too, and so can phosphates, things we might think of like dark sodas, for example, Coke or Pepsi or Diet Coke or something like that that's dark because of the high phosphorus levels, that might hamper the absorption of calcium because we do need a good ratio of calcium to phosphorus in the diet. So, again, if you take a lot of something in, then you would want to keep an eye on that because that could affect it as well.
Well, it's been recommended to have these raisins soaked in gin to help with pain. I don't know. It's fun, even if you don't have any pain.
Yeah.
So what about that? Like 9 to 18 raisins. That can't be very much alcohol, can it?
I wouldn't think that'd be too much alcohol, no.
Yeah, they're pretty bulk. The raisins become kind of round and fleshy. It does absorb some.
Plumps them up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll have to look into that more.
That's the right word.
Okay.
Wait a minute. I do have one more question. I love grapefruit, and I get lots of it when I go to Florida. What about grapefruit? They say don't take grapefruit with certain medicines. Mm-hmm. How about that and calcium?
Well,
is grapefruit involved in calcium interference?
No, not so much. Grapefruit, what it does is there is a component in grapefruit that can affect how your medications are absorbed and utilized in the body. And so, generally, yes, we recommend if you're on many, many medications that may be affected by grapefruit, then you would either have it a different time during the day or use other sources for your fruit. But it's more how it affects how the medication is absorbed and utilized.
Again, nothing but it has nothing much to do with the calcium absorption, and you don't think?
I don't think that would be anything very significant, no.
Well, listen, you have been most helpful. Thank you so very much.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Hi. I have recently begun taking the medication warfarin, which is the generic for Coumadin, to thin my blood, and I was told not to discontinue taking fish oil, which I've been doing just 300 milligrams usually a day.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a question about the effect of flax or flax oil on the thinness of your blood. I suspect it doesn't have vitamin K in it, but I think it might have blood thinning effects. Do you know either of those?
Yes, and that brought up a good point, like you're saying with the Coumadin, which does thin your blood, and then you want to be aware of anything else you might be taking that thins your blood. Garlic is another example as a supplement that you don't want to really be taking a lot over. You want to make sure that stays stable if you're on warfarin or Coumadin as well. And flax oil could potentially affect blood thinning too, because as a fatty acid like that, that could affect blood thinning. So
would that make it thinner?
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Typically that would make it thinner. And so, what will often happen, and you can talk to your physician about this, what will often happen is you'll take a look at everything that you are doing and, try to keep it stable, because as they monitor your blood to make sure that it's at the proper level in terms of the thinning, it's the same thing with, we used to say, gosh, don't have any of these green vegetables and things that are high in vitamin K, because that will, of course, cause the blood to maybe clot differently if you're on this medication. Now we really, general recommendation is more to just don't change your diet. Try to keep pretty stable. If you're eating certain fruits and vegetables, try to keep that pretty stable so then they can make sure the medication is working appropriately. But we don't really say now don't eat those things. We just mm-hmm. say kind of keep them stable. But, yes, I think anything that would be any herbs, any supplements that are herbals, garlic, any fatty acid related or oils or anything like that, those can all have an effect on blood thinning. So,
but if I, you're saying if I, and that they did stress the consistency of the diet, but mm-hmm. if I included maybe the flax would be better than the flax oil, just for the omega-3s,
mm-hmm.
If that's part of my regular diet, maybe they would adjust the.
Yeah, that's what I would ask about.
Another thing around
mm-hmm.
that.
If there are things you really want to take, then I would bring the amount and what you're taking to your physician and say, are there ways I can incorporate this in with my regimen and
right.
what I need to see if that does work out. Sometimes it will, and sometimes they may say, well, let's not mess around with that right now, depending upon your levels. But
mm-hmm.
but I would definitely do that.
But there's no K, I presume, in flax, right?
If there is, it's not a lot, as far as I know.
I
think it's
the other thing, the...
Right. And as you mentioned, if you use the ground flax, then you're actually getting less fat, but you're getting all the other benefits of flax. And so that might be an option to present to your physician too,
mm-hmm.
To still get benefit but not be as high in the fatty acids.
Okay, thank you.
Next, we talk with a listener on line 3. Where are you calling from today?
Hi.
I
have a quick question. I had to have my thyroid removed, so I'm taking levothyroxine now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a problem that runs in our family. So my sister's doctor told her to take calcium and vitamin K together because she said people who have their thyroids removed sometimes develop problems with osteoporosis and things like that. Would you agree with that? Or?
Well, I think that you would want to look at your total diet and see, again, if you can get up to the recommended need diet-wise first.
Mm-hmm.
And, if it's something that could be a potential concern, then you probably want the high level of calcium, which is more like 1,500 milligrams a day, which is hard for some people to get in. It's
right.
considerable amount. So it may be of help to say, yeah, get right on that if that puts you at a little increased risk. Usually the calcium is taken with vitamin D, but not with vitamin K.
Oh.
Because the vitamin D is what helps the calcium be absorbed a bit better. Sometimes vitamin K as well. Vitamin K is important for bone. And
mm-hmm.
so that might have been part of the whole package saying, yes, we want to look at vitamin D, vitamin K, magnesium, and anything that is important for bone formation as well.
Okay. I had a question about decaf coffee, and this is my last one. I heard that sometimes some decaffeinated coffees increase cholesterol levels in people. Had you heard that?
Well, coffee in general, if it's large amounts, there were some reports, because that does have some fat and does that cause some problems. I don't think we have good evidence to say one way or another. It really decreases cholesterol or it really increases cholesterol level. Really, the more solid research, it seems to me, that's come out recently is that it may help manage blood sugars in some ways. So, I would take, you know, caffeinated, whether it's decaf coffee, caffeinated coffee, along the fact of saying as a part of a diet, because it does, as we've mentioned earlier in the show, affect calcium absorption if you get a lot of coffee or if you get a lot of caffeine, either one, to maybe say, gosh, if you had two or three, again, servings a day or a few cups a day, that probably is not going to cause a problem. But I wouldn't go overboard on it in any way.
Right.
I wouldn't drink a lot of coffee to say, yes, this is going to maybe decrease my risk of anything.
Right.
I would just have a moderate amount.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine, our topic, diet and nutrition today. It's a topic we take up once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month. Our guest, Susan Kundrat. She's a registered dietitian, and she is the owner of Nutrition on the Move. So if you have questions about diet and nutrition, you can give us a call. Susan will do her best to help you out. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. Let's take another call now, a listener in Mahomet. Line one, hi.
Hi. Can you go over a little bit about electrolytes?
Sure. Electrolytes, I guess we'd consider anything like sodium or potassium, chloride. Those might be typical electrolytes we'd think of that are naturally present in the body, and they help us manage blood pressure. They certainly help us manage our fluid status in the body. And, you know, we've talked a bit about sodium. I think that's one we think of the most, because when we take in more sodium, our body tends to retain a little bit more fluid or have to keep a little more fluid on board. And that may be one of the main electrolytes that's looked at in your blood, for example. When somebody's exercising and they're losing a lot of sweat, we know that most people lose primarily sodium, but some people lose more. They also lose a lot of potassium or calcium or chloride, too, as well. So they do play a big role in managing blood pressure and managing fluid balance in the body. Those are the main things that electrolytes are concerned that they help do. Sometimes you'll have your blood work done, and if some of your electrolytes are high, it might be because you were very dehydrated. So it'll show that they're high because you don't have enough fluid in your system to kind of balance it out, or you haven't been drinking enough water. And then there could be other reasons they might be off if your kidneys aren't quite working right and keeping that fluid balance normal.
Does that help? Okay, listener is gone. You know, this explains why, you know, maybe after you have had a stomach bug, you know, a stomach upset, that ordinarily some of those processed canned soups like chicken noodle, generally to me they taste so salty I can't abide them. But after I've been not feeling well, it tastes so good.
Right. And that may be just naturally partly
it's
what's
like
happening.
Your body is saying, we need.
Right.
We need some stuff in here now.
Yeah.
So is that helpful then once you're back on your feet to think about that a little bit, you know, just go with the flow and don't worry about it so much?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, because partly when you lose a lot of fluid, of course, you feel very drained when you become dehydrated. And having some sodium with what you take back in helps you keep some more of that fluid in your body. So it helps you stay better hydrated.
Yeah.
And that's probably partly why. And you've also lost some electrolytes, obviously, when you've been sick. So, yeah.
So that chicken noodle soup and a saltine, it's like, oh, man, this tastes so good.
That's why it's good to listen to your body's natural cravings, because there are many cases, I think, where your body's going to tell you what you want, and that's a good one.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener on a cell phone. Line two. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon, Susan. I sort of have a double question. I do have a history or a diagnosis of osteoporosis, so I take Citrical, which has the calcium citrate in it, and I take 1,500 milligrams of that. And for my daily calcium, food-wise, I use about actually a cup of dried milk, which I put into my coffee so it becomes more cafe au lait. Now, I was reading on a website for one of the products, like Poise, that indicated with for maintaining good bladder health, that it's a good idea not to consume too much calcium and saccharin, which apparently can irritate the wall of the bladder. So on the one hand, and unlike the woman with the thyroid, and yes, she needs to take the calcium because I was not told that, and that's why I have osteoporosis, because I didn't take thyroid. I didn't take calcium supplements after the surgery and wound up with the osteoporosis. But what I'm saying is, on the one hand, yes, you need the calcium for the osteoporosis, but two, I guess my question is that does calcium have a large amount or supplements of calcium in this case affect the wall or the bladder health? I mean, it's sort of like, you know, one is good, but if you do that, then you wind up with another problem, or not a problem.
Yeah.
And worsen another problem. So I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Okay. I don't know that calcium in the recommended amounts that we want to try to get in a day, as you mentioned, 1,500 milligrams for you is a good amount, and then you're getting a little bit extra as well, that amount causes problems. I've never seen documented information to say that somebody with bladder concerns should take their calcium way below the recommended intake. Not to say it's not out there. I just have never seen it. But it does, you know, it might make sense to say, and again, this sounds like probably a broken record, but have your moderate amounts that you know you need, but not go over. So in your case, 1,500 milligrams typically is the amount that we say that's a good upper limit to get your benefit from. Mm-hmm. And maybe for you, you'd say, well, if you're getting 1,500 milligrams in your supplement on a daily basis, just make sure that's broken down three times a day and not maybe twice a day or once a day, because it's absorbed a lot better if it's in your system throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be a positive thing to keep in mind. And then just know that if your calcium intake from food does get up above 300 or 400 or 500 milligrams a day, then maybe your supplement can be cut back to 1,000 milligrams a day, just so you're not getting a lot extra. It is sometimes possible when people supplement with 1,000 or 1,500 milligrams a day that in food they may get that much too, and then we're looking at a whole lot of calcium that we think is too much calcium.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I would keep that in mind just to make sure that you're not going overboard on it if you're concerned about this other potential problem. I would stick to probably 1,500 milligrams and no more. And that way, you know, you could feel good about getting what you need, but you're also being aware to not get too much.
Uh-huh. Okay. The other thing is regarding the flaxseed. First of all, in the course of the past hour, you've mentioned things about flaxseed oil and flaxseed, and then also you said ground flaxseed.
Mm-hmm.
So other than the fatty acids in the liquid form, if you're using, I'm not familiar with the ground flaxseed, but do the flaxseed, I was under the impression that if you consume less than 2 tablespoons of flaxseed, then, if a person, I should say, then there doesn't seem to be any problem with, I can't remember if it was absorption of one of the B vitamins, if you use more than 2 tablespoons a day of the flaxseed, or is it specifically flaxseed oil?
Well, the flaxseed oil itself has a higher amount of fatty acids, of course, because it's straight oil. So there, if that's what you're looking for, there could be a benefit for using the actual oil. But for a lot of people, they're also looking for, you know, ground flaxseed itself, which we would call flaxseed meal. Or you can buy flaxseeds and you can grind them in a coffee grinder or in a flaxseed grinder.
Right.
And use those. So then you get all the benefit from the lignans that are in there, from the fibers that are in there, from other things that are in the flax that we think are protective and beneficial. And so from a whole food standpoint, the first place I would go would be whole flaxseed or flaxseed meal or ground flaxseeds, because then you get all the benefit. Plus you get essential fatty acids. You get these good fatty acids. So that maybe for me would be the number one place I would start, and then maybe go to flaxseed oil if you really did need more of the oil or more of the fat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what we, you know, typically say. So, gosh, you can get even more benefit if you use the flaxseed meal.
Are the meal and the seed itself, the whole seed, are they readily available in the supermarket, or do you mm-hmm. have to, and you have to go to the supplement section, or are they in with the flours and...
Yeah. Well, sometimes they're in with the grains and in with the flours. There are a lot of brands now that have become more mainstream, and so you certainly can find them in supplement areas as well at places, but now we're seeing them right by, a lot of times in the grain area or in the cooking area, you'll see all these whole grains. One common one is Bob's Red Mill, but there are several of them you might want to look for, and they'll also have ground flax often right in with the grains, and so that would be something to try. You can mix it in with yogurt or cottage cheese or in baking or oatmeal, works really well in oatmeal. And that's a good kind of place to start where you get the whole food
okay.
as well.
Where do you store right. that? In the refrigerator, in the freezer?
In the refrigerator or the freezer. And you want to close it tightly because, of course, that particularly if it's already ground meal, then the fatty acids can turn rancid. So
okay.
you do want to store that.
And let's take another call here. We're running down on time now. A listener in Muhammad Line 3. Hi.
Hi. How do you get your body to be pH alkaline?
Well, that's a really big question because you can certainly eat more foods that we think of as being less acidic. You know, maybe eating more. You know, it's a big question because sometimes you eat certain foods like milk products, for example, that might not be as acidic, but then they can affect the stomach in different ways. So it's not that simple to do that. So I guess we might want to talk about that another time. But there are, you know, you'll read books to say, you know, eat all these foods that are alkaline foods and that will make my body more alkaline. But sometimes depending upon how they're digested in the stomach, that may cause more acid in the stomach, which then can affect the acidity of your body. So I don't know. I guess my answer to that would be I don't know that there's a real simple way to just make your body.
Do you know any way to make your body alkaline?
Well, again, with food, because the body processes different foods different ways, sometimes it's just not as... I don't know that if you came to me, I could say, yes, you make your body alkaline by doing this. Certainly,
so you don't know any particular foods to eat to make it alkaline?
Well, I would say not because there's a lot of controversy in this area. In other words, just eating alkaline foods doesn't always make your body alkaline, so I would hesitate to say...
What are alkaline foods? Name a couple.
Well, we might think of things like milk products as being more alkaline, for example. But, again, that's not always how they act in the body. So
yeah.
you might have something that the pH of that food is one way, but when it gets absorbed, it's very different or it causes a different reaction in the body.
Uh-huh.
So I wish I could answer that better, but it is a very kind of confusing, controversial area from the research.
Yeah. Okie dokie. Thanks so much.
Okay, very good. Let's squeeze in our last caller this afternoon. Champagne, we'll have to be quick, though. Line one, hi.
Well, I'm a type 2 diabetic, and recently I tried, and read about this, I tried intake of cinnamon and coconut oil, the organic coconut oil,
mm-hmm.
and it did have the effect of lowering my blood sugar level, and I just wanted to ask your guest, is she aware of that, and what in those two items would be attributing to the reduction in my sugar level?
Oh, that's a good question. The cinnamon, there have been some recent studies on cinnamon and its effect that it may certainly also affect blood cholesterol levels as well as blood sugar levels. Particularly it's about a quarter teaspoon twice a day for the blood sugar reduction. And so I don't know that we don't know exactly what all it is in there, but it's probably maybe a combination of things in there. We probably know less about the coconut oil, but there certainly have been some interest in that. And so it might be, too, that utilizing an oil, especially if it's throughout the day or if it's with other carbohydrates, that might have an effect on blood sugar and blood sugar control. So that's potentially what might be happening there as well. Maybe decreasing certain other fats and using the coconut oil might be helpful. But there's probably less research in that area. But really, the research in cinnamon is looking very good.
Okay, there we have to wrap it up. Before we let Susan go, though, I want to mention that this evening she'll be back in the building.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to be on the C is for Crockpot program on our companion station, WILL-TV. She's going to be with Doyle Moore and David Inge tonight, and that C is for Crockpot program starts this evening at 7 p.m. on WILL-TV. So we're looking forward to seeing you.
It'll be a lot of fun.
I think this show is going to be great.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
Okay, so listeners, tune in, and you'll see Susan, you'll see Doyle Moore, another person you hear often on the radio, but, you know, it's radio.
That's right.
So, well, good luck. Break
Thank
a leg,
you.
As they say.
Thank you.
Okay, and Susan Kundrot, she joins us once a month, usually on the first Monday of the month, to talk about diet and nutrition. So we'll talk with her again in the new year. How
about that? It will be amazing.
So happy holidays.
You too.
Susan Kundrot is with Nutrition on the Move.